Okay, so this is going to be interesting, and I think Helmut really took a chance in inviting me. And so, if this turns out to be a disaster, this talk I'm going to give, he's responsible for this. Okay. All right. Anyway, I'm really flattered, you know, for this invitation. And you know, so this is what's going on. So, but for those of you that haven't caught up with this, but so these are the early days of a new discipline that's coming, that's being birthed, and that is people call it mathematical medicine. And I think there's an article out there, you know, on the wall from the local newspaper. Some people call it mathematical biology, biomathematics, and so on and so forth. But it's something new, and so as everything new, so there's many things that don't quite work the way they should. But I'll add a few words about that. So if I say stupidities, be patient, okay? So today we're going to talk about one particular area, and that is how mathematical approaches are impacting cancer research. And as you know, what's going on in biology today, you know, in the so-called post-genomic era, we have the human genome, we have a lot of information out there. The problem in biology used to be, how do I produce data? And so laboratories were competitive based on how many data they could, you know, turn out every day. Today, we don't have the problem anymore. In fact, we're producing way too much data. And nobody knows what to do with this. And that's one problem. The second problem is that we are producing a lot of data where it's easy to produce data, and some of the data, the kind of data that we would like to produce, are not being produced. So there's a couple of things going on. And I think mathematics can address quite a bit of this. Okay, so we have, as of about a year ago, we have at Vanderbilt, we have an integrative cancer biology center. And I can say we have it because we got funded by NCI, and so that's what made it go. And it's really a collaboration between us and the University of Dundee, where they actually have a department of biomathematics, and Sandy Anderson is our main collaborator. So you'll see these two things. They're sort of like and it's a true collaboration in the sense that Anderson goes back and forth. He just went back home yesterday, so he's been at Vanderbilt many times. So it is a true interdisciplinary enterprise. Just about everybody in the Department of Cancer Biology is being involved, and these people have been chosen based on their ability, or their expertise rather, in various aspects of cancer biology that are fundamental to cancer invasion. So remember, our focus is to really model cancer invasion, and I'll tell you why it is important in a minute. And then there's a number of other people that I would say collectively belong to the so-called exact sciences. So chemical engineers, and Peter Cummings in particular, he's a mathematician turned computational biologist, and Sandy Anderson. There's also a department of biomathematics at Vanderbilt that's been instrumental in first of all connecting us with these people, and then they're helping us quite a bit. And then bioengineering, we need measurements. Like I said, you know, some measurements have not been taken. So these people also are very, quite interesting. And then eventually, we'd like to do everything that we do in vitro, experimentally. We'd also like to do in animals and in people. And so we're fortunate to have this Institute for Imaging Sciences at Vanderbilt that is capable of doing quite a bit of investigations on mice and people in vivo, so in real time, as tumors develop and so on and so forth. Okay. So I'm going to give you now, in about 3 minutes, I'm going to give you a tutorial on cancer. And you know, I just assume that you don't know biologically. But so I apologize if I'm talking down to you, but just in the interest of understanding what we're talking about. So cancer. So what is cancer? So as you know, the human body or organs, they're made out of cells. And so most of the time, these cells make structures that make sense. So tissues, organs, so cells normally they will make kidney, liver, brain, and so on and so forth. But in some situations, these cells, you know, become confused. And so even though they try to make some tissues, they don't quite make it. And so what they do, they make sort of non-functional tissues that are sort of jumbled, and those are tumors. And sometimes these tumors get to the point where they don't know their own boundaries. They become invasive. So they start invading, you know, surrounding tissue. And then eventually they make their way into the connective parts of the body, like veins, vessels, blood vessels in general, lymphatic vessels. And they have the ability to also metastasize, so they grow in other parts of the body. Now, As long as this process, this cancerous process, is circumscribed, it can be detected and removed. So that's why early detection is so important. It is, you know, when the cancer is at this level, before it has reached the vessels or lymphatic vessels and so on, then it can be addressed surgically, and most of the time it can be cured. But once it's spread through the body, it becomes a very difficult proposition to cure cancer. And so that is why invasion and metastasis become the focus of most of cancer research, at least the translational research, meaning research that tends to do something for therapeutically. So now, so when I started 20, 25 years ago, so cancer was really a black box. We really didn't know how this happened. We know now that cancer is a genetic disease. So the reason why these cells become confused is because there's mutations in critical genes. Okay, so there's about 30,000 genes in the human genome. And so if you take, for instance, breast cancer, you look at all tumors by, so we have the capability of analyzing all mutations in all tumors in a vast population, okay? You realize about 5% on aggregate, 5% of those genes are changed throughout all breast cancers that have been looked at today, okay? So that doesn't mean that in one particular individual, 5% of the genes have to be changed. But that is, those are the genes that more or less, so 5% of these 30,000 genes, in one way or the other, collaborate, participate, cooperate into changing cells from normal to invasive or cancerous. Now, so now the focus of my talk is really scale. So you can see already something here. I'm going to talk about this a little bit more in detail later. And that is, we have a lot of information at this level, gene level, and we know that information down here determines what happens up here. These are two very different scales. I'm going to talk about this later, and that's one of the issues that needs to be addressed in biology today. So now, this is, tumors don't look like this. This is, you know, drawn. And so this is a real tumor. And I show this slide for two reasons. Okay, so one reason is because, so this is how we know tumors. So this is what has been done here. Imagine a tumor is a three-dimensional structure. So generally what pathologists do, okay, they will make a slice, stain it, and then look under a microscope. And so you see cells here. Not all of these are tumor cells. Some of these are vessels that stain specifically here. Some of these are neutrophils. These are inflammatory cells. Okay, and so that's the first reason, because I think it's always a good idea, you know, you're modeling something, it's always a good idea to look at what does it really look like. It doesn't look like, you know, you can even, it's even harder to tell one cell from the other. The second reason why I say that is because, as you will see, the output of, so we'd like to model cancer, we'd like to do something useful that at the end of the day is used actually in clinical medicine, okay. So this has become sort of the established language in medicine today. So whatever output you have, so if you're going to see, we're going to do simulations of how cancer will grow. So my personal point of view, and the point of view of many people actually, is that at the end of the day, whatever simulations we do, we'll have to look something like this. Because this is how people talk in terms of tumor. So if a pathologist looks at this, he or she will immediately see that this is a squamous cell carcinoma. We'll make some actually prognostic and therapeutic evaluations based on this. So that's what we want our model. That the output of our model has to look something like this. Okay, and so this is just to bring home that point again, that there's a lot of complexity in cancer. So it used to be, so lots of the emphasis has been on the cancer cell itself, and that's because of the genetics of cancer has made, you know, tremendous strides in the last 20 years. But it's now become clear that that's only part of the picture. So in order to understand what happens to cancer and make some reasonable predictions and model it, not only do we have to take into account cancer cells, but also inflammatory cells, the matrix in which, the tissue in which these cells are immersed, other components like fibroblasts, vessels, and all of this interact in some kind of a way that at the end of the day decides whether or not this tumor is going to become invasive and create a metastasis. The metastasis itself is going to have these kind of interactions. So you start to get an idea how complex the problem is if you want to know if the question is, how is this going to evolve? Okay, so here is the problem, and I say here is the problem that biologists are facing today, and that is, so there is a tremendous amount of data out there, but there is no single model that is generally accepted. There is no theory of cancer that everybody says, okay, this is the theory of cancer, and maybe we should all agree that this is it, and we're going to test it. Okay, it doesn't work like that in biology, not yet at least. And so there's mechanistic views. Of course, we'd like to know these things work. You know, just, we don't just want to, you know, sort of make some educated guess. But we'd like to know some of the mechanistic processes that go on. And so some people will say that genetic mutations drive the whole process. Some people focus on protein-protein interactions. Some people talk about changes in the way cells differentiate. Some people talk about the microenvironment, so the surrounding healthy tissue, and so on and so forth. And so I think it's likely that in the end, there is going to be sort of a combination of these things. But the bottom line is that each one of these, there's a lot of biological variables. And so in order to really make some mechanistic, to reach a mechanistic understanding, you have to be able to consider concurrently all of these variables. Okay? And this has become impossible in biology today, because each one of these is a field. So if you look at genetics, okay, there's maybe, you know, 50 journals, I'm just picking a number, but it's somewhere in the order of magnitude, 50 journals that you know, every year publish, you know, thousands of articles. So it's impossible even to keep track, you know, what is going on, let alone putting all together. So mathematical modeling is an ideal approach, you know, to try and describe this process. And this is not only true for cancer, but also for many other diseases. Okay, so what's our goal? So our goal is then to develop a robust mathematical model of cancer invasion that gives us some produce some predictions on how cancer is going to evolve and whether or not it's going to be invasive. And of course, we want to validate this model with some data from reality. And which is, this is so we need a component that creates the model, and then another component that talks to the first component that does experimental validation, and back and forth in a resonating way. And hopefully this will give us an understanding, a quantitative understanding of how cancer invasion works. And I think it's important that our knowledge is encapsulated to use. I never read this, but it's important because I think this is the only way that we can actually incorporate all the data that are being produced, or will be produced. Okay, so now I'm going to give you an idea what the problem is. And like I said, I've come to believe, you know, and, you know, I've been in biology for a long time, and I've never, more than I would like to admit, you know, but there are graduate students here, so, you know, I'd like to clue him into something that is not generally found written in textbooks. And this is the problem of biological scales. And, you know, in the last year or so, I've come to believe that this is perhaps the fundamental problem today in biology we need to address. And we really don't know how. We're starting to, but we don't know how. And so this is how. So one way to look at this is, you know, so there are many disciplines in biology. For example, molecular biology. And it works at this level. Okay, so molecular biology classically do microarray experiments. They will look at genes, okay? And they don't want to know, they don't care. What they think whenever they make some discovery at this level, they want to make some conclusions, you know, about what goes on over here. At the same time, there are cell biologists that sort of look into this, but really what they're working with are cells. Okay, so they look at cells, how they move. So we are, you know, a couple of scales up. There are some people in between that work with subcellular organelles. Okay, some people, like, say, pathologists, for example, they look at tissues. They keep an eye on what's going on here. But really, they try to make a living. So a pathologist will have to look at something here and will have to say, this is a cancer, this is not a cancer. Okay, sure, there's all these genes, blah, 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 but do I care? I mean, I need to know just by looking at it. Okay, so what's going on here is that people are acting at different scales. Now, it is obvious. It is when you put together something like this, it is obvious that these scales are talking to each other. So at the end of the day, what's happening over here is certainly determined by what goes on over here. And there is some kind of a relationship that we do not understand. And one of the problems, I think, is that more often than not, people try to make jumps across these scales. And I think there is some degree of legitimacy, so you don't need to know everything, but until you make some conclusions. But I think we should be careful. And so whenever we produce data, we really need to place them within each scale and make sure that we really understand how many jumps we're making and perhaps what kind of information we need in between. Okay, so typically today, people can produce an enormous amount of data at the molecular level, gene expression data, and they're trying to make conclusions at this level or at this level. So there's a neuropsychologist, a neurobiologist, that are trying to understand how people behave based on changes in genes. Now, it's possible that, you may get lucky, and make a guess. But I doubt this is going to work all the time. Okay, so you need to go through all of these steps of most of them. And, I was going to show you this, but so to give you an idea of where we are, okay, I think I'm getting a little bit late. But, let me tell you in a couple of minutes, okay? So, and the reason why I'm putting this in is because whenever you hear a conference from somebody like me, they always say the human body is like a car. We know all the components. We don't have to put it together. Somebody else says, the human body is like a jumbo jet. We know all the parts, but we don't know how they go together. And if you had all the parts of a jumbo jet in front of you, which we do, would you know how to put it together? So I think the problem is not quite like that. The problem is of scale. It's a little bit more like this. So this is a painting by an Italian guy. His name is Canaletto, I think 16th century or so. So here is the problem. So you can look at this. You can say this is a beautiful painting. But you can look at this painting at a variety of different scales. So somebody may come in and say, okay, I'm going to take this painting, okay, and I don't care if it is Canaletto. I'm going to make a list of all the pigments that were used, okay? Or somebody may scan this thing and say, these are the wavelengths that are absorbed. So you can classify this at a variety of scales. And, of course, all the scales talk to each other. But at the end of the day, if I have a list of all the pigments, am I going to be able to make a guess on what this picture looked like in the beginning? Am I going to be able to guess if Canaletto painted it, or Rembrandt, and so on and so forth? So this is the kind of data integration that we need to know. So we need to have data accumulation at different scales. Okay, and then we need to know how these scales interact with each other, so that at the end of the day, we make an accurate guess for what the finished product is going to look like. I don't know if I made this clear, but we may talk about this later. Okay, so how are we doing this? So now, again, these are the early days. So this is what we are trying to do, and there's many people that are doing things in different ways. But this is how it's working in our group. And so perhaps the best way to think about this is you think about breast cancer. Okay, and so again, what the pathologist, a surgeon will take out the tumor, a pathologist will slice it. So the best way to think about how we turn this tumor into mathematical language is that you take that slice. Remember the slides I showed you before. That's common language for pathologists, okay, for people that work for medical scientists, okay. So you take that slice and you put it on a grid, on a mathematical grid, okay. And so on that matrix now you have cells, okay. And now what you're going to do, remember, this tumor is made out of cells, it's made out of other things also, matrix, vessels, inflammatory cells, and so on and so forth. And so what you can do now, you can do this. To represent mathematically this tumor, you can do this. You can take all of those parameters that you can represent mathematically in a continuous equations, deterministic equations, and just do that. For example, nutrients, oxygen is represented here. These are partial differential equations. You should know. I shouldn't, but anyway. But this is oxygen. This is extracellular matrix. These are proteases, enzymes made by these cells. So these are, molecules just like gases and this and that. They can be represented with the laws of gases of diffusion and so on and so forth. So they're represented with continuous equations. But then we have cells. So every time people have tried to represent cells with this kind of equation, it just doesn't work. And the reason why it doesn't work is because cells, which, by the way, are the main actor here, cells have a mind of their own. So you never know which way they're going to, what they're going to do today as opposed to tomorrow and so on and so forth. So it is best to represent cells. And, there have been models to do this, stochastic models like cellular automata and so on and so forth. So the best way to represent cells is with discrete equations. So at the end of the day, you have a model which is a hybrid model. Partially, there are some partial differential equations that are continuous and other mathematical functions that are discrete. So the combination of these, as you parameterize and run this model, is actually an output that looks a lot like a slice of this tumor. And I'm going to show you how this happens. I'm going to give you actually show you a movie of this simulation here. So just to give you a little bit more detail, so these are the continuous equations, and so these are diffusion functions, and these parameters here, like for instance in this case, we're looking at production of proteases, okay, so enzymes by cells. These are molecules that are thrown into the surrounding environment of the tumor. So this is sort of a diffusion that tells us that these proteases will diffuse at a certain with a certain function, with a, and then this is they will be produced by cells with according to this constant mu, and then lambda is a rate at which these proteases are going to be degraded. Okay, you can go through this. This is also oxygen, more or less the same thing. So in an effort to parameterize the model, and I'll talk to you later about that, you know, is that you can make the model run. I'll show you the way the model runs just by taking values for these, sort of reasonable values from the literature. But what you really want, you want to take values from the actual tumor that you're trying to simulate, okay? Or at least for the type of tumor you're trying to simulate. Now, the cell is the discrete equation for the cells is a different story. So this is a discrete equation. And so what it actually does, remember, we're simulating cancer invasion. And so what cancer invasion means is that the cells are growing together, but then at some point, they start moving around. So movement is very important for cancer invasion. So what this equation actually does, it calculates the probability of a given cell to move away from the spot in which it was born. This is represented here. So again, this is the way we've done it. And so a single cell here at position P0 has a certain probability to move to P1, P2, P3, or P4, which is calculated here. And so this probability also has to do with whether there is a cell here or there is a space that it can occupy. And also it has to do with the ability of these cells to detect extracellular matrix, because cells don't just move in a vacuum, but they move on some kind of a substrate. Okay, so now here is where the critical link between this model and the experimental biology comes. So once you discretize, once you have a hybrid model in which cells are represented with these discrete functions, what happens is that every time, so the way I understand that the simulation runs is that it will look at a cell at this position. So every cell will be looked at when the program runs. So every time the cell is looked at, this before these probabilities are calculated, you can add then a whole new set of conditions that we call the, actually, we now call it the cell life flowchart. Okay, so say a cell is here. So first of all, if the cell is sitting in an environment where there is sufficient oxygen, then it will survive. If not, it will die. Then maybe, you know, we know that a certain type of cell has to age for 12 hours before it divides. So once it hits that, if once it reaches proliferation age, if there is sufficient space, it will divide. Otherwise, it will not divide. It will become quiescent. No sufficient oxygen, it will die. And then it goes into mitosis. And this is a very interesting thing, because this is essentially how cells work. So this is, so you can look at these things, and you can find biological disciplines. So this will be called, you know, apoptosis. So this is called cell proliferation. And here, P53 mutation. So when the cell goes here, you can introduce a certain probability that certain genes will mutate. As I told you at the beginning, that's what cancer is. Genetic accumulation of genetic mutations in critical genes. So as you can see, at each one of these things, so right now, the algorithms here are fairly simple. But here, instead of just having P53 mutation, we chose P53 because it's sort of a very critical gene that guards the human genome, okay? But you can have a whole bunch of different genes, okay? You can also have, say, effects of smoking on certain genes. You can introduce that. So as this thing sort of goes around and around, then as the cell goes through, then it can die, it can stay unmutated, or it can, if accumulates mutations, it can become increasingly closer to a cancer cell, so accumulates mutations. Okay. So in this simple model in which we're only looking at four variables, proliferation, nutrient consumption, production of proteases, and adhesion value, cell-cell, how cells adhere to each other, you can have phenotypes that are increasingly aggressive. So they proliferate very fast, they don't care to attach to each other, so they create the premises for moving around in the body. And so remember this blue color. Okay, so I'm going to show you how this thing actually runs on because, again, we need to have a computer output that experimental biologists like, that physicians like, so that at the end of the day, maybe, you know, they look at, you know, what this means. So these are the initial conditions. I'm going to show you how the model runs if the movie goes. So zero. So this is going to be a simulation over a period of time of 4 months, starting from one single cell. So it goes all through that cycle. In the beginning, so age zero, no mutation. There is a 10% probability that there will be a mutation at p53 as they go through. Remember, when p53 gets mutated, cells become more aggressive, and then so on and so forth. And we're actually going to consider two concentration of matrix. I'll show you how one single variable is going to make a huge difference. And this is the simulation technique. I don't know if that means anything, but it sort of does to me. But so the bottom line is you solve the deterministic equations, and then you assign a wound probability to the cell, and then you examine all the cell properties, and then mutation or mutations, and then the cells will move or will not move according to the scheme that I told you before. Okay, so this is how it works. So I couldn't make these movies loop, but they need to be looked at again. So this is the scheme. Remember, dead cells, blue cells are the most aggressive. So you're going to see the cells growing here. At the same time, you're going to see. So now, right now, the cells, they have this matrix in which they grow, which is a biological matrix, is homogeneous. Okay? So concentration high throughout. Lots of oxygen. And then no metalloproteinases or enzymes degraded, matrix degrading enzymes, because the cells have not made them yet. Okay, so let's see how this runs. Okay, so you see the cells growing here. Maybe not. Okay, there we go. So you see how the phenotype is going to start changing. The cells are going to start dying in the middle, and that's sort of intuitive because the oxygen is running out. And look at the appearance of these phenotypes here, the most aggressive phenotype. So in the end, you get this shape. Remember this shape, okay? And I'm going to make another, I have another slide that summarizes this. But please notice also that the output of all that simulation is sort of like a slice of the tumor. Cells are like spots. Okay, now what we're going to do, we're going to do one thing. We're going to change, out of these four variables, we're going to change this one, which is the matrix. So see, the matrix here is homogeneous, very high matrix. Here, instead, we're going to create a random matrix, which, by the way, is more similar to what goes on in the body, okay? Because the matrix is not just continuous. It's just, you know, the spot and this and that. Also, it changes. You wound yourself, so the matrix sort of changes because, you know, it's being remodeled and so on and so forth. But you're going to see a major change occurring here, okay? And remember, everything is the same except for this. Again, 4 months of growth. The first 1 or 2 months, it's more or less the same. You see this ball becoming larger and larger. The blue cells are appearing. But now look what happens now towards the end. It slows down a little bit, and then you start seeing this fingering. So, and this is, I think it's in the next slide. So the major difference then is that when you start changing one single variable, and this is two different ways that we've changed. So here we made it just granular. Here we've made the matrix sort of, you know, spotty or bumpy. Okay, everything else is the same, but look at the difference in the results. So this is what, you know, a pathologist would call a you know, a well-contained tumor, almost a benign tumor. Here instead, you have an invasive tumor. So it's fingering in. That's where the word cancer, by the way, comes from. It looks like a crab. So this is interesting. And so remember, what we've done essentially here, and I think this is brought home. So everything was more or less the same. We changed one variable. And what has happened is that the major change we've seen was at the scale of tissue. So go back to those biological scales. So when you look at the molecular subcellular scale, the signature of those cells, so they were all blue cells. Okay? So the phenotypes that were selected, they were more or less the same. They're always aggressive, invasive phenotypes. That sort of makes sense because they're competing for resources and everything. But by changing one variable, which was the matrix, boom, you get a change at this scale now, at the tissue scale. Okay? And by the way, we've done this also with changing oxygen. And it seems that the general rule that is coming out is that the harsher the microenvironment, so if you drop down the oxygen to levels where the cells are just gasping for air, you get the result very similar to the bumpy or the granular matrix. Okay? So, and it seems to be that the general rule is that the harsher the microenvironment which the cells live, the more aggressive tumor, the more invasive tumor you get. So if this is the only thing that you're going to remember, okay, this is critical because this is really where this slide here, this is where mathematics becomes important for biology. Okay? And that is this kind of prediction actually is start that comes out of a mathematical model is starting to drive the experiment that the experimental biologists do. So I would have never thought, of doing the experiment that we're doing, today, sort of linking these things. But if we want to test this model and validate it in real life, this is the kind of experiment that we need to do. So now mathematics are starting to drive biology. And this message hasn't come home in the biology community at large, but I think this is why the fusion between mathematics and biology is inescapable, because mathematics is starting to offer direction to a biological community that is sort of going around confused in this mass of data. Okay, so let me see. So these are the properties, just to summarize the properties of the model that Sandy Anderson wrote. So it's a hybrid model. It includes discrete variables and continuous variables. Now, a very important thing is that I showed you just three or four things, but I also told you that there's a lot of variables that we have to take into account, and it's a lot of them. Okay? But Sandy's model is open to include additional variables and parameters at various scales. So you've seen oxygen, that's atomic scale essentially. You've seen cell death, that's a cell scale. You've seen the output at the tissue scale. So the model is really a multi-scale. Sandy also tells me that moving it to a three-dimensional simulation is no big deal. And then, of course, because of this intuitive link with the way biology is done, it can also be testable and validated both in vitro and hopefully also in vivo. So if I have another couple of minutes, I want to give you an example of this, but very quickly. And so we ourselves have realized, so Sandy's model is right here. So that growth that you were looking at is anywhere between 1 million and 10 million cells. Okay, tumors can be, of course, have billions of cells. So now I told you that not everything can be predicted by one single scale. So we started to look also at a lower scale because there's a lot of stuff that goes on, when cells. So as you could see before, so we're just looking at cells growing, just looking for space and this and that. But cells are not exactly dots. They're more than that. So we started to look at the model at this scale from, say, 10 to 100 cells. This is interesting because this is the work of Katia Reyniak, very talented young mathematician. And just very quickly, okay, I don't have time to go through this, but the reason why we focused on these things that we call mammosphere, as you might have guessed, our focus is on breast cancer. And so, as you know, you need different models. You cannot only work, with stuff, tissue that comes from people. So mammospheres are interesting. You can take one single cell, you can grow it in a three-dimensional environment, and you get a structure that more or less resembles how the mammary gland is made. These are cells in the mammary gland that make milk. The milk goes in here, and then everything is, it goes out to the nipple. This is a representation of that. And so, we can actually make these things in vitro. And you can see an analysis by confocal microscopy. You can see the cavity in the middle, and this is like we're taking one of these things and sort of slicing through back and forth. You can see the cavity here. Okay? So this, we're also using this model, and we'd like to create numerical mammospheres, and I think Kasia has done it. And the reason why this is a model for cancer is because, see, remember those genes that cause cancer? You can introduce those genes into these semi-normal cells, and then instead of getting mammospheres, you get these nasty things that are starting to invade. So it's a fairly neat representation. You can do this in about 10 days. Okay, so this is sort of interesting. It sort of models cancer invasion at a slightly different scale, at a lower scale. And this is the model that Kasia has put together. And fortunately, these are the parameters or the variables that she, variables and parameters that she has looked at. She had to take into account different phenotypes of the cells. And fortunately, I don't have time to go through this. But this is just to say that what I'm going to show you next is not a Disney movie, but is actually driven by these equations, and we can change these parameters. And you can see now new things coming up that we were not even caring about, like viscosity, pressure, fluid expansion. This shows you a different scale, different things have to be taken into account. This is the movie. This is the simulation. Single growing cell, this is the nucleus in the middle, is going to divide now. This is the contractile ring that biologists know very well. Now you have two cells. One of the first things that these two cells do, well, they divide again into four. Now they start making adhesion, so they stay together. Now we're looking at, so the cells continue to do that. And then to make that structure that is hollow in the middle, actually the cells here, they die by a process called apoptosis. Okay, so this is now neat because now we have a numerical representation of a biological process that we can manipulate in vitro. We can change genes at will and then verify this model. And there's a number of questions here. This is just to tell you how this is the way we're parameterizing the hybrid model. These are all the parameters we're measuring. And what I was going to say here, we're fairly thin in, so we as the biological community in this kind of measurement, cell adhesion, migration, we need bioengineers to do that. And this is just to show that some parameters cross the scales, proliferation, cell adhesion. Others do not, are important at the one of the cell scale, but they're not important the other scale. So this again, to bring home the idea that when you look at data, just remember, where do they play a role? Can I ignore these at this scale, and do I need something else at that particular scale? And so this is sort of our roadmap. Version 0 is being parameterized. We're sort of going around in this circle right now, producing this data, and then we'll have a version 1 pretty soon. And so this is our main model. The technical name is MCF10. We're producing numerical mammospheres, these two models, two different scales. And this is another way of saying the same thing. And so this is sort of the overall thing that we're doing. And I put this in because, so model 0 goes to model 1, experimental validation here. Eventually will be a 3D. Hopefully, eventually we'll run on an iPod. So, but this is very important. So there's two things that are very important. This, dissemination and training. So this has become one of our main activities. Like we had a workshop, mathematicians and biologists in August. We put that on DVD. We have 17 hours on DVD. This is becoming important. I think you can tell that to do the biology this way, we are going to need a new kind of person, a new kind of scientist that can speak fluently both the language of mathematics and the language of biology. And so these guys, will have to come from somewhere. Certainly, I'm not going to be one of them. I'm going to struggle. But, the new generations, they're going to carry, this into the next implementation. And then the applications of this are obvious, choice of treatment. So essentially, you can take a tumor from a patient and ideally should be able to characterize how this tumor is going to grow over the next 6 months, 6 years, make some decisions that are based on hard data, mathematical models, rather than saying, okay, maybe we should do this, maybe we should do that. Drug discovery is also an application of that. And, I had to show you this. Oops. Oh, that is good. There was Aunt Sandy Anderson. Oh, no. Where did that? Still can't see. Okay. I have to show you that because there may be friends of Sandy's here in the audience. There may be friends of Sandy Anderson. I want to make sure that I show his picture. That he doesn't yell at me. And yeah, so you actually become friends when you do these things, and there's no other way. So there has to be physical proximity between mathematicians and biologists. This is Sandy Anderson, Alisa Weaver, and myself as we were writing the project that likely got funded. Okay, thank you.